So when Sylvia asked me to teach this class many months ago, actually, I already knew that I wanted to teach about compassion and self-compassion in the context of our tradition here. Practices that help us deepen into the open-heartedness and the clarity and the courage that allow us to know how to respond wisely to the events of our lives. And the recent events in Newtown, Connecticut, remind us all how essential it is to have practices that hold us, that allow us to see clearly and keep our hearts open in the face of difficulties and challenges as we attempt to care and care deeply about the suffering of all beings. I wanted to read the poem by Roshani that probably many of you have already heard, and I've put copies of it on the back table. If we run out, then just email me and I'll send it to you. There is a brokenness out of which comes the unbroken, and a shatteredness out of which blooms the unshatterable. There is sorrow beyond all grief that leads to joy, and a fragility out of whose depths emerges strength. There is a hollow space too vast for words through which we pass with each loss, out of whose darkness we are sanctioned into being. There is a cry deeper than all sound, whose serrated edges cut the heart as we break open to the place inside, which is unbreakable and whole, while learning to sing. There are two other perspectives that I just simply want to mention before I go deeper into the Dharma talk. There's been more and more available on the internet now as people are responding to the events of last Friday. One is yesterday, the New York Times opinion page, the Opinionator blog, posted a very thoughtful and insightful article called Guns and the Decline of Young Men by Christy Wampole, who's a professor at Princeton. And it's a very insightful perspective into the societal and cultural forces that are shaping young men growing up in our culture today and the things that might have contributed to what happened in Newtown on Friday. The other is the post this morning from the Greater Good Science Center at UC Berkeley on how we can find strength and goodness in this time. And they mention some scientific data, they are the Greater Good Science Center, that supports the ideas that compassion and forgiveness is everywhere. And you may have seen on the various YouTubes that are available, one of the fathers of a child who was killed in Newtown, Robbie Parker, offering compassion to the family of Adam Lanza, saying that we don't want what happened here to define who we are as human beings, that we have to open to a larger understanding of who we are. Another point that Greater Good made is that schools, in fact, are safer than they ever have been before, that children are resilient, and that peace is possible. So those are two perspectives that you can find online that might be helpful. I think they're truthful and useful as we're holding the events that have happened recently. In our own tradition, we're taught that wisdom and compassion are the two wings of the Dharma, that both are essential on our path of awakening, and in fact, they are deeply intertwined as we try to come to an awakened well-being. We have to have a clear mind, and we have to have an open heart to find the true release from suffering as we try to love ourselves and the people we do love, and as we try to come to love and care for all sentient beings. In order to be truly free of suffering, we have to be able to look and see clearly what is happening in the moment as it's happening, and we're taught to see it without judgment and without resistance, simply allowing a recognition of what is happening, a deep knowing of what is happening that will allow us to deepen into the wisdom of how to respond. Compassion is the practice of opening our hearts in the face of suffering, whether that's our suffering or other people's suffering. And it's the compassion that allows us to look. It allows us to keep our hearts open without denying and without repressing and without fixing too quickly or moving away too quickly. It's what allows us to have a moment to tap into the deeper wisdom that teaches us how to respond. Compassion is considered one of the four Brahmaviharas, one of the four sublime attitudes or the heavenly abodes, the states of mind and heart that are naturally available when we're not contracted in fear or anger or grief or overwhelmed by shame. And like another loving kindness practice, metta, we're encouraged to practice compassion for ourselves as well as for other people. May I be safe from inner and outer harm. May I be free of suffering and from all causes of suffering and from causing any suffering. May my suffering ease. May my suffering cease. And as with loving kindness practice, sometimes it is easier to practice for other people than it is for ourselves. We may have a belief that self-compassion practice is selfish or self-indulgent. When so many other people are suffering, losing people that they love to death, maybe not having the resources that we have to cope with dying and death, how can we turn the attention to ourselves? Isn't that selfish to do that? I want to address that concern. I hope to have experiences today to take time to learn some practices of self-compassion where we can experience for ourselves that when we can keep our heart open in the face of our own suffering, it is much easier and more natural then to keep our heart open in the face of the suffering of others. Do I need to do anything? Okay. I was inspired to talk about self-compassion because I read Kristen Neff's book on self-compassion. I've asked that it be available in the bookstore. I hope that it is. I also wrote a newsletter about the book in September. It's archived on my website. And then I had a chance to meet Kristen in October when we were both presenting at a conference in Seattle on integrating mindfulness into psychotherapy. And we talked for an hour, just standing in the hallway, talking about integrating mindfulness and compassion practices into a kind of unified practice of awakening into well-being. And then I had a chance to take her training at IONS a couple weekends ago. Kristen discovered self-compassion practice at a meditation group in Berkeley about 15 years ago. The group was oriented toward the teachings of Thich Nhat Hanh. And then she began researching self-compassion when she became a professor at the University of Texas in Austin. So she was already practicing and learning about self-compassion when her son, Rowan, was diagnosed at the age of 4 with autism. And for a while there, it was just hell on wheels. It was uncontrollable tantrums many times a day, and incontinence, and no verbal language, and no sociability with other kids, and no eye contact with her and her husband. And Kristen learned that she had to put on her own oxygen mask first. She had to be compassionate with her pain and her sorrow and her doubts about herself as a mother before she could comfort and compassion Rowan. Her book tells the story, and you can also find the story on a wonderful documentary called Horse Boy, which is the story of the family's journey to Mongolia to seek and receive healing from the shamans there. So Kristen now has developed a training in mindful self-compassion. It's similar to mindfulness-based stress reduction. It's being offered with Christopher Germer, and you can find out more about that on her website, selfcompassion.org. There are three parts to this practice of self-compassion, and we'll go through them, and I'll try to give examples, and then we'll do some practices. The first step is mindfulness, and these practices are not necessarily always done in a linear order, but I'm talking about them in a linear order. So one of the practices is mindfulness. It is recognizing what's happening in the moment. It's taking a pause and noticing that there is suffering happening in the moment. It's a moment of, ouch, this hurts, or this sucks. It's not judgmental. It is a wise reflection. It's a wise discernment that suffering is happening here. And the mindfulness allows us to notice the experience but also our reactions to the experience. I feel lonely. I feel sad. I feel rejected. I feel angry. I feel frustrated. So the mindfulness allows us to notice the experience, but also the experiencer. And that moment of noticing and naming what the experience is gives our brain a precious few seconds to keep the higher brain online and functioning so that we have a chance of not being hijacked by the experience. We have a chance of being present and engaged and aware so that we can take the moment to figure out how we want to deal. I have an example to illustrate how this might happen. I was one day worried about something and not paying attention to where I was going, and I blithely walked into a sidewalk of freshly laid wet cement, and I went up to my ankles in wet cement. And the cascade started of, oh, how could you be so stupid? How could you be so clumsy? Why weren't you paying attention? And in the middle of that, because I was pretty harsh, I just stopped. Stop that. I don't want to beat myself up for being clumsy. I was just not paying attention. I made a mistake. I am not the only person on the planet who made a mistake today from not paying attention. I can offer myself a little understanding and compassion and forgiveness here. And as I picked my feet up out onto the sidewalk and took my shoes off, I began to realize that, yes, shit happens, but shift happens too, and that I could change my attitude in that moment and offer myself more understanding and compassion and forgiveness for what had happened. And by the time there happened to be a faucet on the apartment building right nearby so I could wash my shoes off, by the time the construction workers came over with paper towels to help me wash off my shoes, I realized that in that moment I could practice, and I could practice in any moment. Any moment where there is suffering, I can practice shifting my state through compassion and kindness for myself, and that's always available at any moment. The second step of the practice is opening to interconnectedness, that we come to have the understanding that my pain, as real and present and compelling as it is the pain of the human condition. I am not the only person that has ever felt or is even feeling in this moment this particular pain. And that opening up to the connectedness of other people sharing these same experiences allows me to take my own pain not so personally, and it allows me to move from a perspective of me to we. And then we can find ourselves and the pain that we're in held in a larger compassion and a larger grace than we ever could have imagined. So I have three stories to illustrate this step in the practice. This is about 10 or 12 years ago now. I happened to be in the auditorium when Jack Kornfield and Pema Chodron were interviewed by Michael Krasny on compassion from the Tibetan and Theravadan points of view. So after they talked, and there was a chance for people in the audience to ask a question, a woman stood up and said, well, how can compassion hold the suffering when you've lost someone you love to suicide? And the whole auditorium got very quiet. And Jack said, would anyone who has lost a loved one to suicide please stand up? And 300 people stood up. And Jack asked the woman to look around and to see the other people who probably knew something of what she was suffering in that moment, and how that understanding, that opening up to the interconnectedness, is available to us in any moment. It's a very important part of our compassion practice. Another story that illustrates that is last Friday, there was a Deepening Joy group meeting in my home, and that was the day, of course, of the shootings in Newtown. So we had a celebration there of deepening joy and deepening friendship in our community, and had to create a space in our own hearts that was large enough to hold the losses of the families that had happened that day, and the losses of anyone who has lost someone senselessly, or even as a natural part of existence, and to hold in compassion the people who couldn't come to the group that night because someone was sitting with a mother-in-law who was dying, and someone else was sitting with a sister who had just had surgery for breast cancer, and someone else's arthritis pain was so bad that they couldn't come. So that we're always practicing how to open up our awareness of our own pain and suffering to the larger field and holding more and more people in our awareness. And the last story that illustrates this is, this was years ago, and one of my cats died. And I was talking to a friend of mine, and I was somewhat apologizing because here I was in so much grief for losing a beloved pet, while I knew there were people that week, I knew there were people who had lost people that they loved. And my friend Paul said, "But Linda, love is love, and loss is loss." So we take any moment of our own suffering as the opportunity to open to the wider field. As Kristen quotes in her book, a British novelist, Jerome Jerome, "It is in our faults and failings, not in our virtues, that we touch each other and find sympathy. It is in our follies that we are one." So we use our mindfulness, our loving attention to the experience of this hurts, and then our awareness of compassion, feeling with. Compassion literally means feeling with, so that we can feel with the suffering of other people and let in their feeling with us in our moment of pain and suffering. And then the third step is proactive self-care. That compassion is a moment of, "Oh, sweetheart, I'm so sorry. I understand. This really hurts. I understand and accept you completely, exactly as you are." And that moment of caring about our suffering does several things. Researchers have found that the initial suffering, the initial upset or startle or grief or fear or anger or shame, activates the threat system in the brain, and so we're mobilized for fight flight. Compassion activates the caregiving system in the mid and the higher part of the brain, so that we're actually activated to move in the direction of care. Compassion activates the motor cortex in the brain, and it primes the brain to respond with care. So when we pause and we notice and we say, "This hurts," we allow some caring to arise, we're actually priming ourselves to do the soothing and the comforting that a good parent would do, that good reparenting would do. Researchers have found that when people practice self-compassion regularly, we have formal practices that we might do on a retreat or as part of our daily meditation practice, but when people practice self-compassion regularly in the moment when the pain is arising, that there are several benefits to that, as there are any time we practice any of the positive prosocial emotions. One is that we overcome the negativity bias in the brain. We overcome the tendency to believe our negative beliefs and our negative stories about ourselves. And researchers have found that people who practice self-compassion regularly are more optimistic. They are better connected to resources, including better connected to other people. They feel less isolation and separation. They feel more loved and more cared for. So this is possible when we practice self-compassion, even in the midst of difficulties and hard times. The researchers have been able to see that the Tibetan practitioners who are very adept at compassion practice actually activate a shift in their brain activity. There's more neural activation that lights up in the left hemisphere of the brain, and they can see that when the monks are practicing compassion in the fMRI scanners. And when there's more neural activity in the left hemisphere of the brain, it means we're activating the approach system of the brain rather than the avoid system of the right hemisphere. So when we practice compassion and self-compassion, we're actually opening up our brain to approach our experience and stay engaged with it rather than avoiding it. We can get compassion and caring from other people, and we do. We do all the time. That's very skillful means. If we're suffering and we notice that and we care about that we turn to other people for support and comfort. But we also have to be able to practice self-compassion in the moments when no one else is around, in the moment, and it's up to us. And I had a very simple example of that. Last Saturday, I was preparing this talk, and my car was in the shop for an oil change and a tire rotation. And the dealer called and said, well, and by the way, we also found this and this and this, and it'll be another $1,000. And I literally said to him on the phone, I am going to take a moment to breathe. And while he was on the phone, I could feel, ouch, this is a little difficult. And I could shift to gratitude that they found something that they could fix before I killed myself or someone else on the freeway. And then I could notice, wow, I took a moment. I took a moment to care about myself and shift. And then I got back on the phone with him and authorized the repair. But it just makes a difference when we can notice and open to our own suffering, take a moment to care about that and to shift, to figure out how we want to respond, and then respond wisely. So if self-compassion is so good, it's such a good practice, and it's a powerful practice, it mobilizes us, why don't we do it more often? And I want to try to address that too. What would get in the way of us doing this practice? So even though we are taught in this tradition that we are all nobly born, we may come to believe that we don't deserve self-compassion, that others deserve it more, and that we should spend our time sending compassion to other people rather than to us. We may not know or remember that we are worthy of receiving self-compassion ourselves, that self-compassion is a powerful and skillful practice. With the negativity bias that evolve for our own survival as individuals and as a species, we tend to notice negative experiences more intensely, and we tend to encode them more deeply in our brain. It is harder for us to notice, pay attention to, and take in the positive experiences. We have to swim upstream a little bit to do this. So there actually has to be a conscious choice to practice self-compassion and to allow that kind of understanding and positive experience for ourselves. We may not have experienced much comfort or care in our own growing up. And we may not have learned the practice of self-compassion, and we may have even learned that to have compassion for ourselves was wrong or bad, that in fact it is selfish or self-indulgent, or that if we try to care about what's happening to ourselves, that that is weak or being a sissy, that we'll become too self-absorbed and that we'll just wind up wallowing in our misery. And actually, the research shows that that is not true at all. That self-compassion is not self-absorption. That self-compassion is self-awareness and self-acceptance and self-care and self-love. That it is actually a very empowering, mobilizing practice. Sometimes we try to fill in the hole in the heart that we've experienced growing up with accomplishment and with self-esteem. And it's true that competence and mastery are very important for a sense of resilience, that adaptive self-esteem works very well. It's very healthy to have a healthy sense of self-esteem. But we grow up in a very competitive and comparative society. And very often, striving after a sense of self-esteem really brings up a sense of less than. Compared to other people, we wind up feeling less than. It's the trance of unworthiness that Tara Brach teaches about. Another colleague of mine calls it the abyss of deficiency. We can wind up being triggered into what Pema Chodron calls Shenpa, being triggered into worries and concerns about the comparison and the competition, into envy and into jealousy and into aversion or anger or even self-hatred and self-loathing. So that a negative self-esteem actually can become a very negative self-absorption. And it can lead to various forms of narcissism and prejudice and bullying. So the negative self-esteem is not so good. The healthy self-esteem, however, is contingent. It's contingent upon things going well. So when we're into selfing and striving after that kind of self-esteem, we're banking our sense of goodness on something that could disappear. It works well when things are going well, but it falls apart when things fall apart. We become actually more isolated and disconnected. So they're finding that self-compassion is actually the perfect practice when things fall apart or when the rug is pulled out from under us. When we can offer care and comfort when we are vulnerable, when we are imperfect, that's when we can keep the heart open and connected to resources, and we actually wind up coping better. They have found that self-compassion is more effective to pull people out of anxiety and depression than is self-esteem. Self-compassion is what allows us to hold everything in a larger awareness and understanding, no matter what. So self-compassion is never a bypass. It's never a denial or a minimizing. It's always an opening that opens up us to a larger field of awareness. The Buddha taught that none of us are exempt from experiencing the eight winds of change, that every human being is vulnerable to experiencing success and failure, praise and blame, gain and loss, pleasure and pain. And in order to cultivate the equanimity that we need to meet the eight winds of change, equanimity being another of the Brahma Viharas, we need a compassionate holding of our experience to be able to help us to move into that equanimity. So how do we do this? And I actually wanted to teach a few practices of self-compassion and then have us talk about it. One, of course, is the formal practice, and I've already been alluding to that. We can send ourselves wishes for self-compassion. May I be free of suffering, from all causes of suffering, and from causing any suffering. May I be safe from inner and outer harm. May my suffering ease, and may my suffering cease. Practices of compassionate touch are very helpful in helping us move into a sense of self-compassion, because touch, the warmth of touch, is actually very soothing to the nervous system. So Kristen teaches putting the hand on the heart. I have taught probably every time I've ever taught here at Spirit Rock, teaching hand on the heart. James Barras and Tara Brock teach you to put your hand on your cheek. Oh, sweetheart. So we'll do the hand on the heart exercise. It only takes a minute. And it's a wonderful resource for you to be able to use throughout the day to have self-compassion throughout the day. So if you would let yourself sit comfortably, you can allow your eyes to close if you wish. Bring your awareness into this present moment. And then gently place your own hand on your own heart. Let yourself feel the warmth of the touch of your hand on your heart center. And begin to breathe into your heart center deeply and gently. If you wish, you may breathe into your heart center a sense of goodness, a sense of ease. A sense of peace and well-being. And then with that steady, call to mind a moment when you felt safe and cared for, loved and cherished by someone. And this could be a moment with anyone. It could be someone close to you, like a partner or a parent or a child, a good friend. It could be a spiritual figure like Jesus or the Dalai Lama. But it could be a neighbor or a teacher back in the third grade. It could be a beloved pet. And let yourself have the feeling again of what it's like to feel safe and cared about, deeply loved and cherished. And when that feeling is steady, you can let the memory go and simply be aware of the feeling in your body. Any warmth or ease. So I can say in a minute why that works so well. But any questions or reflections or comments on doing that practice? Yes, Roger.
The thing that really helps the most was just that momentary feeling of safety, which is so important to me.
Right. So let's understand that the feeling of safety is essential to us as human beings. We are hardwired for our threat response to go off in less than a second. And so as our higher brain comes online and we can begin to do these practices 3 to 5 seconds later, it's really important that we can quickly evoke a sense of safety and calm down the nervous system. We're working with our own evolutionarily hardwired in biology. And it's really essential to have practices that can do that. Thank you. Anyone else? So why this works so well, as we know from meditation and yoga traditions, that breathing itself, deep breathing, will calm down the nervous system. When we breathe positive emotions into the heart center, that brings a more coherent heart rate variability, which also calms down the nervous system. When we think of moments of feeling safe and loved and cherished, that activates the release of oxytocin in the brain, which is the hormone of calm and connect. It is the body's direct and immediate antidote to cortisol, the stress hormone. So anytime we activate the caregiving system, we can activate the release of oxytocin and change the physiology within our body and come into a calm state. So it's a very skillful practice to do. And I teach people, I do myself, hand on the heart many times a day because it really works. Another practice is to have what Kristen calls a self-compassion break. So many times a day, checking in. How am I doing? Is there any suffering here? How can I bring a moment of kindness and care to myself in this moment? How can I remember my true nature, my innate goodness, and that I am worthy of self-compassion in this moment? And to do that many times a day, we get very busy, we're careening, we're coping, and to do that can reset our mindset, keeps our heart open. So I'd like us to just try that for a moment. I'll just lead you through those phrases. So again, if you can let yourself sit comfortably. And just notice, without judgment or resistance, how am I doing? Is there any suffering here? And if there is, noticing and naming, just briefly naming the suffering. And then how can I soothe myself in this moment? How can I bring care and compassion to myself in this moment? How can I let myself know that I care? Can I remember my true nature, my own inner goodness? And from that place, offer myself understanding, care, and compassion. And then notice what shifts inside you as you do this practice. And if there is any more ease or comfort, taking that in. So again, any comments or questions or reflections on that? Yes, please.
So when I checked in to see how I was feeling, I noticed some anxiety about the fact that I usually ride my bike here. I usually have my husband with me, and today I don't have my husband with me. I need to ride by myself, and I have a little bit of anxiety about being on my own. So when I was doing what I thought was the compassion practice, it didn't actually feel like compassion for what I was feeling. It felt more like my brain telling me 5 or 6 reasons why there really wasn't anything for me to worry about. Mm-hmm. So is that self-compassion, or is that just my brain whirling around?
No, of course that's self-compassion. That's activating the cognitive component of our higher brain. And we do look for pastimes when we've done well. We look for pastimes when nothing went wrong. We look for ways to reassure ourselves out of our best thinking. That's fine. The practices that I'm offering today are more body-based, because the need for compassion is more body-based. Anxiety is a physiological state. And so when we want to calm down the physiological state of anxiety, we do practices of touch or evoking memories of being cared about to do that physiological somatic. So you might do the talking part to calm yourself down enough that you can remember to do the physical practices as well.
Actually, I could feel when I'm anxious, I get this feeling in my stomach, and as my brain was going along, I could feel that sensation dissipating.
That's wonderful.
So that whatever my brain was doing seems to be working.
That's great. Thank you. Anyone else? We may also be getting some of the physiology regulated because we're sitting in a room of people who are regulating themselves. And so we may be picking up the calm of other people as well, which is one of the benefits of meditating in a sangha. Okay, so there's another practice that I'll have us do, which is more in the form of a guided meditation or guided visualization. So if you'll again sit comfortably. Allow your eyes to close if you wish. And let yourself first feel compassion for someone that you know is suffering. Someone mentioned earlier here today, someone in your family, a neighbor who just broke their ankle and has trouble bringing their groceries home, someone who lost their luggage at the airport coming to visit you. A child or grandchild who missed the bus and the bus went off to the class picnic without them. Let yourself feel the natural warmth, caring, goodwill, empathy, compassion, and love that you can naturally feel for this person in this moment. And when that feeling of warmth and love and empathy and compassion is steady, don't change anything. Just keep that flow of compassion and love going. And simply slip yourself into that stream. You're sitting in front of yourself and you're sending that compassion to you for any moment of pain or suffering, however big or small. And just simply let yourself receive your own care, your own soothing and comfort, your own understanding and compassion. Ah, I'm sorry you're going through this. I understand and I care. I love you exactly as you are, as you go through this. And if you notice the compassion flowing to you, simply let yourself receive it and take it in. You are feeling with your own experience. So again, any comments or reflections? Any questions about doing that exercise? Was it possible to do that exercise? So this is something that's very useful to do as a more formal meditation practice anytime we're going through a long period of suffering or grief and doing this on a regular basis, because it's the natural capacity of our heart to flow in compassion when we're not contracted. I'll do one more exercise, but I'll have you do it with a partner. So if you would be willing to find someone to work with, turn so that you can sit and face each other with your chairs, and then I'll lead you through the exercise. Does everyone have a partner? So briefly introduce yourselves to each other and decide who will be A and B. So this is an exercise in practicing all four of the Brahma Viharas: loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. I first learned this here at Spirit Rock from Jack Kornfield. I know that Joanna Macy teaches it, and I learned a variation a couple weeks ago from Kristen Neff. So you begin, you'll sit so that you can look at each other comfortably, not straining your bodies. But you begin by closing your eyes and letting yourself become aware of the goodness of your own true nature, the nobility of your own Buddha nature, that is wise, compassionate, generous, patient. And let yourself become aware of the inner goodness that you know is in your partner. The nobility of the Buddha nature that you know is in your partner. And then we begin by A's, opening your eyes and looking at your partner. B's, keep your eyes closed. And A's, begin to send wishes of loving kindness to your partner. May you know deep happiness. May you have ease of mind and heart. May you know deep inner peace. And B's, let yourself receive these wishes from your partner, taking in the goodness of their loving kindness. And then A's, close your eyes. And both of you reflect for a moment on the experience of giving or receiving loving kindness. And then B's, open your eyes and begin to send wishes of loving kindness to your partner as you gaze at them. And A's, receive the loving kindness coming to you. B's, sending wishes, may you know the deepest happiness. May you have ease of mind and heart. May you know deep inner peace. bees close your eyes, and you both reflect on your experience of giving and receiving loving kindness. And then, A's, open your eyes again and let yourself imagine any sorrows or griefs, challenges or difficulties that your partner may have experienced on their life's journey. And begin to send them your sincere wishes of compassion. May you be safe from inner and outer harm. May you be free of suffering, free of all causes of suffering, free from causing any suffering. May your suffering ease. May your suffering cease. And bees, let yourself receive the compassion from your partner. And then, A's, close your eyes again, and you both reflect on your experience of giving and receiving compassion. And then, B's, open your eyes. And as you gaze at your partner, let yourself imagine any griefs and sorrows and losses, the trials and tragedies that your partner may have encountered on their life journey. And begin to send them your sincere wishes for compassion. May you be safe from inner and outer harm. May you be free of suffering and from all causes of suffering, and from causing any suffering. May your suffering ease. May your suffering cease. And A's, let yourself receive the compassion offered by your partner. And then you close your eyes, bees, and you both reflect on your experience of giving and receiving compassion. A's, open your eyes again, and as you gaze at your partner, you imagine the joys and delights and the celebrations and triumphs that your partner has experienced on their life journey. And you send them your sincere wishes for happiness in their happiness. May your happiness increase. May you delight in your delight. May you know my delight in your joy. And bees, let yourself receive this mudita, this joy in your well-being. And then A's, close your eyes and you both reflect on your experience of giving and receiving joy. And then B's, you open your eyes and gaze at your partner and imagine the joys and delights, the happiness, the triumphs and celebrations they've experienced on their life journey. And send them your sincere wishes for their happiness. May your happiness increase. May you delight in your delight. May you know my delight in your joy. And A's, let yourself receive your partner's joy. And then, B's, close your eyes. You both reflect on the experience of giving and receiving joy. And then, A's, you open your eyes again, and as you gaze at your partner, you know that your partner has experienced the eight winds of change, success and failure, pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame. And begin to send them your sincere wishes for equanimity and calm. As you ride the ups and downs of your life, may you have deep inner peace, balance, wholeness, and B's, let yourself receive the wishes for your own equanimity and calm. And then A's, close your eyes again, and you both reflect on the experience of giving and receiving equanimity. And then B's, you open your eyes, and as you gaze at your partner, knowing that they have experienced on their journey the eight winds of change, success and failure, pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame. Send your partner your sincere wishes for equanimity. As you ride the ups and downs of your life, may you know equanimity and calm. May you know a deep inner peace, a balance, and wholeness. And then, bees, close your eyes, and now you both reflect on your experience of giving and receiving equanimity. And then, keeping your eyes closed for one more moment, shift to an awareness of the entire experience in this moment. An awareness of yourself and noticing anything that has shifted in how you hold yourself in this moment. So if you can thank your partners, and then come back to the large group. I see a lot of smiles. I saw more than one hug. You know, the research shows that a 20-second hug is enough to release oxytocin in the brain. So when we hug people for 20 seconds, which is about 3 full breaths, we can activate that calm and connect response in our nervous system and come back into a sense of safety. So before we come to a wrap, any comments or questions or reflections on this exercise, on this morning, on self-compassion in general? Yes, please.
As I was sitting here and my whole body settled down and it felt right, peaceful and everything else, and I just wanted to mention something which I relate to this, is there's a Japanese photographer, I can't remember his name, Mamamoto or something, and he's taken pictures of water.
Yes.
And if you Google Japanese, I can't remember his name, it starts with an M. If you Google Japanese photographer in water, you will see the pictures.
Right.
And it is such an eye-opener.
Mm-hmm.
People just stand and yell angry things at a glass of water, and he takes photos like through a magnifier to look at the molecular structure of water. Even if you write anger, hate, and paste it from a piece of paper on a jar of water, the same thing happens. Then he has pictures of if you say, you know, love, peace, etc. And go online and have a look. It entirely changes the molecular structure of the water. When it's positive, it's beautiful. It's like pictures of snowflakes. Everything's like symmetrical. It's beautiful, all the thing. And the other looks like a bad accident where everything is squished and it's ugly. You just look at it and you know on a body cellular level it's ugly. It's really fascinating. So if it does it for water, what does it do for us when we are sending positive thoughts? Because I could feel my whole body shift in this. So it's very powerful.
Thank you so much for mentioning that. I've seen that and it is totally amazing. And think of what happens when we send loving kindness or compassion or joy or equanimity to our fellow creatures who are 93% water. Right. Any other, Roger?
I was
sort of returning to the thing of safety, and what I noticed with my partner Terry was after all of those, and we both had a moment and felt that the result was subtle, but for me, it really, I felt safer.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what
mm-hmm.
kind of the,
right.
Yeah.
And there's such a yearning to feel safer in our world, even though we know we live in a world that is impermanent and transient. Physiologically, we're evolutionarily hardwired to need to feel safe. So these practices help us do that. Yes?
I thought it was interesting how taking time can feel rigorous, but in a good way. I was trying to find the right word.
Mm-hmm.
This was really fun, and it was also rigorous, I think, in a sense, because it was step by step,
mm-hmm.
and it's gentle, so trust seems so important. Even
Absolutely.
Though it's gentle and it's small, it seems so huge to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt like my brain, I always now, because I'm so heady, I felt like I needed to check in the final instruction about what happened physiologically
mm-hmm.
For me
mm-hmm.
was that my brain literally felt like it widened, like in this really nice, spready sort of way.
Right. Well, then I'll say something I wasn't planning to this morning, but I often teach this, that when we do these practices that open our awareness and open our heart, we're actually shifting the processing of our brain from a very medial, in the middle of our brain, processing, which focuses on details and tasks and activities, and it's what pulls the sense of self together. Our sense of history and personality and identity is pulled together by the structures in the middle part of the brain. When we do these practices, and I often do this practice to evoke this sense of brain processing, we're actually moving the processing of the brain out to the sides of the brain. I don't know if anyone was here Saturday for Rick's talk about not self in the brain, but we move it to the sides of the brain, and it actually loosens the connections of the processing, and we're more likely actually to have insights and epiphanies and revelations when we're in that mode of processing in the brain. So it actually does change what's happening in the brain. So thank you for mentioning that. Yeah. Any other? Yes, please.
Is your book for sale yet?
I forgot to say that. It's available in April 2013, published by New World Library. So it'll be available in April. Yeah.
And all these strategies you were talking about today, are they written down in the book or somewhere else that
Many of them are in the book, but I also post, I have a sign-up sheet in the back for my postings. So I have a monthly e-newsletter, weekly quotes, and weekly resources for recovering resilience. And so more and more of those are being posted on my website. They're all archived on my website. So you can just go to my website and download free. Yeah. Okay. And Dharma talks are also posted on my website, so this talk will be posted in a couple days. Okay. Any other comments or reflections? Yes, Julie and then Maggie.
I felt tremendous energy coming into my body, the chi kind of energy
mm-hmm.
from Qigong,
mm-hmm.
and it was just an amazing
mm-hmm.
experience because I felt myself shaking
mm-hmm.
with that positive energy,
right?
And I felt waves of the energy coming over me.
Mm-hmm.
No words for it,
right.
But simply that experience.
Because you're in a field of people who are practicing,
yes.
and the chi
yes.
is heightened.
Right. And I appreciated that we weren't talking.
We need time and quiet and space to rest, to come into the heart space that compassion can come from and that wisdom can come from. So I'll just say one last thing to wrap up and then we'll sit for a minute. So self-compassion practice is actually a very skillful means. It is self-awareness and self-acceptance and self-allowing. It is a proactive, intentional choice for comfort and soothing and care, and it is what creates the mindset and the heart space from which the wisdom will emerge of how to act wisely in our times. The two wings of the Dharma, wisdom and compassion, And as the contemporary Indian sage Sri Nisargadatta says, wisdom teaches me I'm nothing. Love teaches me I'm everything. Between the two, my life flows. So let's sit for just a moment. May all beings everywhere heal and awaken into the compassion and awareness that can hold and honor the fullness of being. Blessings on your practice.
Thank you. Thank you for your generosity.
Oh.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.